Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. 2 months ago, the remains of what are believed to be at least 55 U.S. troops who fought and died in the Korean War were returned by North Korea and flown home to American soil to hopefully eventually be identified and restored to loved ones. It's also believed some of the remains are those of Marines who died at what has been called the greatest battle of the Korean War, the conflict at the Chosin Reservoir. As we'll hear today from author Hampton Sides, it was a misbegotten campaign almost from the start, a brainchild born of the hubris from those at the highest chain of command, a campaign which unwittingly led thousands of U.S. Marines into a deadly trap set by the communist Chinese. Sides' new book is called On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, the Korean War's Greatest Battle, and it recounts a story of the terrible odds facing those Marines and of the valor shown almost to a man as they sought to extricate themselves from an almost impossible situation. Hampton Sides, welcome back to Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
And as always, let's get the number out, 888-477-9499. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, you can also email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. This was just a terrific book. It was terrific. Let's start simply by talking about who the men of the 1st Marine Division were, those who were heading to Korea in 1950. They were young. They were 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, some of these
very, men. Very green. Many of them were reserves who had done a little bit of training at college campuses. They ended up doing most of their training on the decks of the ships as they were heading to Korea, this place they'd never heard of before. Luckily, a lot of the officers were seasoned warriors. They had served in the battles of like Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and they knew how to fight. So what you had is a very green group of young men led by some very seasoned officers. And they made their way to all, you know, this country with all these unfamiliar place names. They literally, most of them had never heard of Korea.
And they didn't know much about Korea.
Yeah, no, none of us did at the time. And maybe that's still the case.
well, briefly to the Korea of 1950, Kim Il-sung was in power, the grandfather to today's leader, yep. Kim Jong-un. Mm-hmm. And Kim Il-sung decides with a little warning to invade the South, and the city of Seoul falls.
Right. He had an army that had been supplied by Stalin. It was very much a puppet state of the Soviet Union. And Kim led this blitzkrieg across the 38th parallel in June of 1950, took Seoul in 3 days, kept pushing south to almost to the very bitter end of the peninsula, where the South Korean forces, and with American help, dug in and tried to hold the line as long as they could, until MacArthur, a little later in the summer, got this idea, hey, let's not fight the fight there anymore. Let's go do an in run. Let's go into the port of Incheon, which serves Seoul, and have this amphibious invasion with shades of Normandy. And let's take this place, a very unlikely place to land because of the huge tidal fluctuations. They won't suspect us. They won't think we'll land there. We'll take Incheon, we'll take Seoul, and we'll turn the war around in a hurry.
So let's focus on this moment in time just a bit before we get to the battle at Chosin Reservoir. Mm-hmm. General Douglas MacArthur, as you said, you know, decides to surprise the North Koreans by attacking at the navel of the peninsula, as mm-hmm. as you write. Mm-hmm. And he chooses a date that he believes will work, September 25th, because of his perception that Asians are attached to numerology?
MacArthur had all kinds of weird ideas. He really thought because he'd lived in Manila for so long, that he understood the Asian mind, as he put it. And one of the things he said was that Asians are interested in numerology. And this would have been 3 months to the day after Kim Il-sung had invaded the South, and that it would be devastating to the psyche of the North Korean soldiers to have that turnaround happen 3 months to the day. I don't know where he gets these ideas. He has a lot of crazy ideas. MacArthur's a fascinating, odd character, you know, in love with himself, in love with the vertical pronoun, as they like to say. Mm-hmm. Probably the most arrogant, most narcissistic, most grandiose commander we've ever had.
And the man responsible for executing the initial assault was said to be MacArthur's opposite, Oliver Prince Smith. If you mm-hmm. could just characterize General Smith, who, as you write, demanded a reckoning of war's exact costs.
Yeah, Smith is the protagonist of this book. General Smith, one of the great underrated generals in American history, was a commander of the 1st Marine Division. He was very much a field commander. You know, he was on the ground, and he understood, of course, that it was not his place to dictate strategy. It was his place to execute strategy. But as we get deeper into the story, we see this conflict between General Smith and General MacArthur and MacArthur's aides, because they have sort of two different philosophies of how to conduct war. MacArthur's really into sort of dashing maneuvers, pincer maneuvers. You know, he speaks in this Napoleonic military jargon. You know, he speaks about anvils and hammers and mighty blows, and Smith rolls his eyes at this kind of talk, and he's much more practical. He's much more pragmatic. He's also just a very interesting guy. Unlike many gung-ho Marines you might think of, he's kind of an intellectual. He smokes a pipe. He reads the classics. He cultivates roses in his spare time. He's fluent in French. He's traveled all over the world. Very wise and very prescient commander who sees the coming battle up in the mountains of North Korea well before it happens.
So Seoul is eventually retaken by the Americans. There's enormous destruction, and the date of September 25th, that arbitrary date set by General MacArthur, does not help matters. Mm-hmm. The next inevitable step, it was thought, was to cross the 38th parallel into the north. This was MacArthur's plan. What did President Truman think about this?
Well, MacArthur, it should be said, the Incheon invasion was just hugely successful, spectacularly successful. And it was a brilliant stroke, of many people said, of genius. And so now MacArthur's riding high. He can do no wrong. His stock is as high as it's ever been. And he starts to get the idea, well, all right, we've taken Seoul. We can go to the 38th parallel, restore the pre-war borders. But why stop there? Let's keep going. Let's go to Pyongyang. Let's pursue Kim's armies all the way into the north. Let's go to the mountains. No, let's go all the way to the Yalu River, the border with China, the border with Manchuria, and make Korea a one nation, just like Kim was trying to do, but in reverse. Let's make it all South Korea, essentially. And Truman, you ask about Truman. Sure. Truman, this was music to Truman's ears. Everyone wanted this in Washington. But they also feared that the war would escalate into a world war. They were worried about the Russians. They were worried about the Chinese. And if they entered the war, it would truly become a world war.
But at the same time, as you put it, back home, as all this is happening, and this is your writing, an obnoxious young senator named Joseph McCarthy, who seemed to find the color red beneath every stone, he was targeting the Truman administration.
Oh, very much so. This was the midterm elections, very much the time period we're living in now today. McCarthy had been surprisingly successful in inflating tensions and making people fear that communism was winning the day both at home and abroad. So Truman had this sort of gnat in his ear as he was trying to think about do we push forward or not. He flew all the way to Wake Island, a little teeny island in the middle of the Pacific, and met with MacArthur. And MacArthur assured him then that this was an easy war. It was going to be over by Thanksgiving. The Chinese would not enter the war.
So there was no thought that as the U.S. marches toward the border, the Yalu River, the border between North Korea and China, that China would just stand back and kind of look on passively? Is that the,
some of the experts thought they would get involved. Others just said that, look, they're just recovering. China is from this long civil war. Their army is devastated. They're exhausted. They're trying to build a nation, a new nation now. They do not want to get involved in a war like this with a mechanized modern army like the United States and the UN forces. So most people said they're not going to enter the war, and even if they did, we'll slaughter them. It will be a cakewalk.
So on the Chinese side, what was Mao? Mao Zedong thinking, the Chinese leader?
Well, Mao was extremely frustrated by the fact that he had won this revolution and this civil war, and yet so many people in the UN, so many countries in the UN, including and especially the United States, did not recognize him as the legitimate leader of the most populous nation on earth. He was also eager to kind of flex his muscles and show that he was a world power and that he was a communist power, but also separate from this. I think a lot of people in the United States thought this was just purely world communism, that there was hardly any difference between Stalin and Mao. But of course, there was a huge difference. Mao had his own agenda, and he was genuinely worried about the notion of American forces pushing up that peninsula, camping out on the very banks of the Yalu River. It was said it would be the equivalent of what if the Chinese army invaded Mexico and pushed all the way up to the Rio Grande and camped out there? How would the United States react to that scenario?
So, Hampton, you alluded to American firepower just a moment or so ago. The Chinese, if I get this correctly from your book, most of Mao's soldiers were powerless and desperately poor men.
The army itself, I mean, it was a peasant army. These were guerrilla forces. They were from the hinterlands. Many of them had known no other life but war. They had been fighting in the Civil War. They had fought against the Japanese during World War II. They had fought against Chiang Kai-shek's forces backed by the Americans after World War II. They were... And they were not very well armed. That's another thing. Many of these
holes
forces,
with knives attached to the end of them.
Unbelievably archaic kinds of weapons. And Mao had this idea that you just send a wave of guys into the battle with guns, and then when they fall, the second wave comes along and picks up those weapons.
So contrast,
and keeps moving.
Contrast Mao's attitude toward his men to General Smith's attitude toward his men.
Well, Mao believed that he had this idea that it's not weapons that win the day in the end. It's what he called fighting spirit and the revolutionary spirit. And he had some success, you know, during the Civil War. His forces were nimble, light on their feet. They traveled overland. They lived off the land. They were expert at camouflage. They were expert at ambushes and sort of the element of surprise. Whereas our forces, the Marines, as they're pushing up north to the reservoir, are tied to their vehicles. We're a mechanized army. We have our tanks, we have our rolling artillery pieces and our jeeps and all of our equipment, and we are in some senses slaves to that equipment.
We get into that conflict in just a moment here on Radio Times. Have to take a break for the moment. Hampton Sides is author of On Desperate Ground, and it is a chronicle of the perhaps the Korean War's greatest battle at the Chosin Reservoir. If you'd like to call us, 888-477-9499. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moskowain has the day off today. General Douglas MacArthur was certain the Chinese would not step into the Korean War in 1950. Unfortunately, he was terribly wrong. And we've got author Hampton Sides along with us today to talk about one of the Korean War's greatest battles, that at the Chosin Reservoir. His new book is called On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, the Korean War's Greatest Battle. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So going into the break, Hampton, we were setting the table, if you will, for the campaign to the Chosin Reservoir area and then on to the Yalu River, which is the border with China and North Korea. And we were talking a little bit about the Chinese and the Chinese army. You go into detail in the book, and you really kind of bring personality to life. And before we get to the Chinese plan, we were talking about Mao. You describe him as a man who rarely showed himself to the public and conducted much of his state business by his pool deep inside the palace complex, often wearing a terry cloth robe and slippers. He was a man of strength and vitality with hideous teeth. Tell us just a little bit more about Mao.
Well, he was still a man of mystery at that time. People didn't know that much about him. We, of course, would later learn that he became arguably one of the great kind of monster dictators of modern history during the famines and so forth that we saw in China. Power corrupts absolutely, and it certainly corrupted him. But this was early, you know, in his day. He had only the year before won the Civil War, and he was an incredibly charismatic person. He was also someone who prided himself on his understanding of military strategy. He read incessantly all the great classic battles of ancient Chinese history, and he was intimately involved in planning the strategies in the Korean War and followed the movements very closely. He also had a son who was in the war and died in the Korean War, who was killed by an American napalm attack. So it's not like he's this removed figure in Beijing. He's very much listening and paying attention and ordering the various movements as everything begins to coalesce around this frozen lake up in the mountains of North Korea.
So as the Americans begin to push forth north of the 38th parallel, what was the Chinese plan?
Well, the Chinese plan was to lure the Americans forward, to keep them coming up that single road. There was only one road that wound its way up into those mountains, stretch them out over a long distance, 70 miles or more, and then to surround them and to begin to chop this long line, this long convoy of vehicles up into little pieces and snippets. It's a technique they had used during the Civil War to great effect. And the idea was to make them look weak at first. They would actually probe a little bit, and there would be an ambush, a little attack. And the Americans would say, well, this was easy. There's nothing here. These aren't actual forces. This must be volunteers or rogue forces that have come down from Manchuria. This can't be Mao's real army.
And that's exactly what happened.
And that's exactly what happened. And in the first phases of this battle leading up to the main battle at the Chosin Reservoir went exactly according to Mao's playbook. The Americans just kept moving forward. They said, this is not a real threat. And Mao said he wanted to increase their arrogance by, you know, coaxing them to move forward and move up into those mountains where they'd be more and more vulnerable. Finally, they get to the reservoir, and they are completely surrounded in the mountains of this area, and Mao has them where he wants them. And on the night of November 27th, all hell breaks loose, and that's when the battle actually begins.
Let's digress for one moment. One concern General Smith had regarding the North Korean winter, which he felt would be the third combatant. Mm-hmm. And there's a passage from the book, Hampton, that I'd like you to read if you would.
Yeah.
Which really describes what the Marines and other forces were up against.
Right. Yeah, I don't think they were used to they knew it. They had heard it's cold in North Korea, you know, but they had no idea how profoundly cold it would be and how much it became this, as you say, third combatant. It was a factor in this whole battle, beginning to end. Okay, picking up here. At the mess tent, a cup of scalding coffee would accumulate a skim of ice within minutes. Canteens and sea rations froze solid. Fingers stuck to metal. Helicopters refused to rise. Truck engines balked. Rifles seized. Batteries fizzled. The cold seemed to come with only one upside. It had a cauterizing effect on wounds. Blood from bullet holes or shrapnel tears simply froze to the skin and stopped flowing. The quartermasters had already issued the men warm winter clothing. Windproof trousers, alpaca-lined parkas, heavy woolens, mountain sleeping bags. But the gear was inadequate to combat this kind of cold. In Coterie, warming tents were set up, with kerosene heaters roaring night and day. Some men, however, needed more than simple warmth. They needed to go straight to the infirmary. Dozens of Marines had collapsed, as though from exhaustion. They seemed to be in shock. They were dazed, semi-conscious. Their vital signs became erratic, and their respiratory rates dropped to dangerously low levels. Others suddenly transition from this catatonic state into a hysterical sadness, sobbing uncontrollably. The Navy medical corpsman developed a term for these extreme cold casualties. They were shook, they said, a description that seemed to get at both the physical and the psychological aspects of their condition. General Smith noted in his log that stimulants were required, in addition to warming, in order to restore the men to normal.
So frostbite was an enormous concern, as much perhaps as a bullet wound?
Oh, yes. I think 85% of these men suffered from frostbite, and not just during the battle, but really for the rest of their lives. The veterans that I interviewed, all of them had these peripheral neuropathies. Many of them were missing fingers or toes. You know, I don't know that we've ever put our forces in winter conditions quite like this.
And on the other side, the Chinese soldiers who were not equipped at all, some of them were up there in tennis shoes, mm-hmm. sneakers.
Even worse for them. And countless Marines told me they came across Chinese soldiers who just froze to death in their foxholes, mm-hmm. just standing in a foxhole, frozen solid.
And again, some of the Chinese soldiers are very young, 16 years old, 17 years old.
Incredibly young. And, you know, almost to a man, the men that I interviewed, the veterans, said that they don't hate the Chinese. They don't resent the Chinese. They view them as brothers, you know, that they went through this ordeal together because of that third combatant, that cold. They feel sorry for the Chinese in the sense that that Mao put them into this battle without equipping them. Even, you know, perfunctorily.
So you focus on this 1st Marine Division in the book, but there were UN forces there, and we've got a tweet which asks, were the British Royal Marine commandos involved in the battle?
Yes, they were. There's a lot of other players. It's not simply a Marine story. I think maybe some critics of the book may say I've drunk too much of the Marine Kool-Aid. Some of the Marines may say I didn't drink enough of their Kool-Aid. But yes, there were Army guys, there were Air Force guys. 10th Corps, which has bunch of different entities within that. Some South Korean troops. There were Navy pilots flying off of aircraft carriers. There were incredibly brave newspaper correspondents and photographers there. And, you know, I try to focus on a lot of the different people who are involved in this battle. It's not just a Marine story. So point well taken.
Yeah. Well, so the head of the 10th Corps is General Ned Allman. And mm-hmm. again, just to bring one more character into this conversation, describe him. He's kind of a little bit more along the lines of MacArthur, perhaps, with the hubris.
Oh, absolutely. Well, he is MacArthur's right-hand man, handpicked by MacArthur to lead this 10th Corps, of which the Marine Division is part. They call him Ned the Dread. He was one of these, you know, whip-cracking officers who would saunter into a situation and make pronouncements and leave without reading anything or gathering an intelligence. He had absolute contempt for the Chinese. He just said they were a bunch of laundrymen. He said, you're not going to let a bunch of laundrymen stop you. He was put there to execute MacArthur's orders, and he was essentially kind of a mouthpiece for MacArthur. And throughout the book, I describe the evolution and the relationship between General Smith and Ned Allman. They really come to hate each other. Yeah. And, Smith realizes at a certain point that he's got really four enemies. You know, he's got the terrain, he's got the weather, he's got the Chinese, and then he has Ned Allman.
Well, he's also got, there's starting to be information that's coming in that the mm-hmm. Chinese are more of a threat than those higher up in the chain of command believe they are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And Douglas MacArthur decides to visit Korea. He's stationed in Tokyo, mm-hmm. Wants to do a flyover over the Yellow River, ostensibly to see for himself what the Chinese threat might be. He sees nothing, but you write, yet the Chinese were there, hundreds of thousands of the masters of camouflage.
Right. I think MacArthur, in a sort of the peculiarly self-referential mind of his, thought that if he flew over the Yalu and if he didn't see Chinese down there, they aren't there. Not that he's any kind of expert on aerial reconnaissance, but I guess he thought he was. But the Chinese were down there. They would do things like, first of all, they only traveled during the nighttime because they were terrified of American air reconnaissance. And they would cover up their tracks with brooms and pine boughs. They would strap themselves to trees during the day and nap standing up, so you couldn't see them from the air. They, as I said earlier, never traveled on roads. They traveled over the hinterlands. Most of this country is desolate. It's wilderness. And therefore, MacArthur did not see them. And so this increased his hubris even more. He said, well, they aren't there. I don't know what they're talking about. The Chinese are just not there. So he flew over the Yalu, went back to Tokyo, and told his commanders to forge ahead.
All right, so we're going to get to that battle right after this telephone call. William in Yardley, Pennsylvania, joins us now on Radio Times. Hi, William.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. So what's your question or comment?
Yes, as I said, as a former Marine, and my cousin was also a Marine who was at the Frozen Chosen.
I thought there's no such thing as a former Marine.
Yeah, well, okay. he had told me that they were supposed to be assisted and met up with the 124th Army, but that the 124th Army left them, or as he used the term, boogied. Is that a correct statement?
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, William. It was extraordinarily difficult at that time. At some point, the Marines were in desperate trouble, as we've gathered. But to get, we can talk about in a little bit the reinforcements that attempted to get to the Marines, but it was not the 10th Corps. And I'm not sure where the 124th Army fits into all
this
picture.
Me either, actually, no. You know, there was a whole other battle that was happening on the west side of the peninsula involving the 8th Army. They also were surrounded and ambushed, and they went into headlong retreat. And it was a sort of a ignominious failure on the west side. The Marines on the east side realized early on that they were going to have to fight this battle, and it was ultimately going to be a fighting withdrawal. Yeah. But how you execute that fighting withdrawal will be what we talk about next.
So let's get to the 7th Marines Company. The E Company, Easy Company, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it was called. Mm-hmm. They make it to something called Hill 1282, which is a spur along the North Ridge in North Korea near the Chosin Reservoir. They dig in for an extraordinarily cold night. And if I'm remembering correctly from your book, they really still don't know what's ahead of them. Then First Lieutenant John Yancey hears, as you write, a mashing noise, a queer and disconcerting sound that was both delicate and huge. It sounded, he thought, like thousands of feet walking across a carpet of cornflakes. And again, if you could read one more passage from the book on that, starting at the bottom of page 157, you can really illustrate what First Lieutenant Yancey and the other Marines in the E Company were experiencing at that time.
Sure. By now, Yancey could hear an even more bizarre sound. Some Chinese drill sergeant was down there crying out in the night, and his chant spread among hundreds of approaching enemy soldiers. The words were uttered in heavily accented English. Son of a bitch, Marines, we kill. Son of a bitch, Marines, you die. Nobody lives forever. The chant, uttered over and over, carried eerily on the wind. But it was drowned out by a louder sound, a ghoulish din of cymbals, drums, bugles, whistles, and bleeding shepherd's horns. This was how the Chinese units, lacking radios, signaled to one another across distances. The strange bedlam sounded, said one account, like a witch's conference. It was, said another, a terrible moonlit serenade, a nightmare scene, a lunatic's delight. Finally, the requested star shells boomed in the sky and lit the hillside in the harsh blue glare of phosphorus. The scene was terrifying. It looked like a whole battalion of Chinese swarming up the slope toward Yancey's platoon. Off to the left, another enemy contingent screamed down from the ridge and bounded straight for Gallagher's machine gun. They came in a rush, said one Easy Company rifleman, like a pack of mad dogs. Another said it was as though the snow had come to life.
So how did E Company react?
Well, you know, considering what they were up against, they reacted with incredible bravery and resourcefulness, but they were outnumbered 10 to 1, if not more so. They luckily had in their commander, the platoon commander, this seasoned World War II veteran, John Yancey, who's a real character.
And he suffers.
No, amazing.
Injuries, you were writing, he was struck by a bullet, which, you know, hopefully people aren't eating at this time, but which pried his right eye from the socket.
Right.
And yet he kept going.
He didn't know what else to do. He popped down onto his cheekbone and he popped it back in his eye socket and kept on fighting. It was that desperate. Most of the fighting was hand-to-hand combat. A lot of it was like literally knives and shovels and butts of rifles. It was horrific. I don't know that very many American forces throughout our history have ever fought quite like this. Some of the battles in the islands of the Pacific, perhaps. Add to this the cold. It was 25 or 30 below zero at the time. A lot of the weapons wouldn't fire. The grenades wouldn't detonate. And they're suffering from frostbite and, exposure, dying of exposure in large numbers. So
the Yancey story is not the only one that you write of like this. These Marines, some of them seem to keep going against incredible odds, wounded. You know, any other person would just be, I'm done, lying on the floor. What kept these men going?
Well, the Marines will tell you it's something special about the Marines. They have this special quality, a special sense of camaraderie, something in their training, something in their whole ethos. But I think it's also, what human beings are capable of doing in extreme situations. The extremity of this predicament brought forth some kind of unusual survival instinct that was quite ferocious and runs throughout this book.
More on the Battle of the Chosen Reservoir in just a moment here on WHYY. Hampton Sides' new book is On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle. The story continues in just a moment. Keep it here. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and our guest for the hour is Hampton Sides. His new book is On Desperate Ground. It talks about one of the most ferocious battles, if not the most ferocious battle in the Korean War, the Battle at the Chosen Reservoir. And going into the break, we were talking about one particular, I don't even know if you can call it a skirmish, but eventually, Hampton, it becomes apparent to the that the march to the Yalu River, the border between North Korea and China, is over. It can't happen. And as you referenced a little bit earlier, General Smith decides to organize an advance to the rear, which is really a retreat, although the Marines didn't think of it in that manner.
An advance to the rear, a retrograde maneuver. One of the reporters there at Hagaru, which was Smith's headquarters, said, "So you're retreating, is that it?" And Smith said, "Retreat, hell. We're just marching in another, we're just attacking in another direction." And that became his most famous quote, "attacking in another direction." But what he meant by that is when you're completely surrounded by overwhelming numbers of the enemy who want to kill you, a movement in any direction is by nature, by definition, an attack. It was not going to be easy. They were going to have to stage this fighting withdrawal, which is one of the most difficult maneuvers in military science, and march out of those mountains in a way that protected itself, protected its own flanks, using close air support from airplanes, artillery where necessary, and sort of in stages work their way down out of those mountains, march their way to the sea, fighting every step of the way.
So you focus on closely on different individuals involved in this conflict in your book. And another one of the side stories here, the 7th Marines Fox Company is trying to get from, is it Udomni? Is that how it's
Udomni.
To Hagaru. And it's facing annihilation. A plan is hatched to go off-road for a rescue. A 24-year-old chosen to lead the march is a man named Lieutenant Chu In Lee, the first Chinese American officer in the Marine Corps. Who was he?
Interesting guy. He'd grown up in Sacramento. He'd always wanted to be in the Marines. He a lot of his fellow Americans wondered, is this a good idea to have a Chinese Americans fighting against the Chinese? Will he show true loyalty to the Americans or will he show loyalty to the nation of
and his. And he knew this.
Yes, and he had, you might say, a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. You know, he had to prove himself. He had to prove that he was an American first. Just as some Japanese American officers had to do in World War II. He very much proved his loyalty early on. He got injured early on in an earlier skirmish. But in the end, he got called upon to lead this march that you talk about, to rescue a group called Fox Company. And their idea was, all right, we're not going to go along the road. We're going to take a page from the Chinese playbook. We're going to go overland. We're going to go into those mountains. We're going to slog through snowdrifts in 35-degree below zero weather, and we're going to surprise Fox Company and relieve them. That's exactly what they do, and who do they appoint to lead this march? Chu In-li. His language skills came in handy at various times. He impersonated a Chinese soldier on a number of occasions and got out of some hot water that
way.
So
this was to throw the Chinese off.
Yes, exactly.
What would he do?
He would yell at them, Chinese here, I don't know, whatever it was to make them think that don't shoot at us, until they got a lot closer. And then, actual combat would ensue, but bought some time for himself.
So in the fight that ensued, when a Marine died, you write he was buried in the snow. The head of the Ridge Runners, as of course this rescue group was known, was Lieutenant Colonel Ray Davis. He would later rue this decision, as you write. But really, Hampton, did he have a choice?
No, he didn't.
They didn't have the strength. The manpower and the conditions were terrible. They couldn't carry their brethren back.
That's right. these remains that were returned recently from North Korea. There's so many more out there on those hillsides that we will never find guys who died in combat or guys who were marched, who were captured and marched to the north and died along the way, guys who were shot down from in airplanes. They're still strewn across that battlefield.
Yeah. This was nearly 70 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So many of these people are passing away or they're gone. Mm-hmm. You've talked to North Korean veterans or veterans of the North Korean War?
Well,
about this conflict?
I've spoken to, during the course of the research, I probably interviewed 70 or more American veterans of the battle. I also interviewed a number of Chinese veterans long distance through Skype in Taiwan who had some very interesting observations about their point of view on the whole battle. I also wanted to sort of understand how this conflict played out in the eyes of North Korean civilians and focus in the book on one particular man. He's actually now an American living in Cincinnati, Ohio, of all places. He's a doctor, Dr. Bae-suk Lee. But he was a North Korean who had escaped to the South before the war broke out. And then ultimately, after his uncle and aunt were murdered, he joined the American forces and went back to his hometown of Hamhung and saw this battle from a very unique point of view. And I focus a lot on what he saw and what his family went through during this conflict.
So eventually, the war ends. The armistice is negotiated between North and South, pretty much at the 38th parallel where it was before the start of the war. Again, it's easy for us to look back with the benefit of time, but did the vets you talked to, the American veterans, did some think it was not worth it?
Some are bitter about it. You know, it ended in a stalemate. It ended where it started in a way. They say, we died for a tie. And I think Americans in general have trouble understanding that. Like, we understand victory, World War II. We understand loss, Vietnam. But this was something in between. And I think they're all equally bitter by the fact that this is a forgotten war. This is a war that has not really entered the public imagination, with the exception of MASH, in the way that other wars have. But those who go back to Korea, and the Korean government has this amazing program where they invite back veterans to thank them for their sacrifices. You go back to Seoul, and I went with a group of them early this summer. And the veterans are looking at Seoul, this modern, highly functioning city, this amazing democracy, the capital of the 11th largest economy in the world, this boom town. And they say, you know, maybe it was worth it. Look what we accomplished here. Look across the DMZ over there. Look what they've got. And look what's happening here. It's exciting to see. And a lot of them feel that that they were doing the right thing. They were there in support of a principle, and they were there in support of democracy and in defiance of world communism. And to that extent, they succeeded in at least restoring that border to its pre-war place.
Yeah. So without giving away a lot of the detail in the book, which really fleshes out not only the battle, the retreat, and the eventual success of the Americans to finally get out of there, mm-hmm. if you will. I'd like to just focus some more on some of the detail that you provide in this book about who exactly was involved. Mm-hmm. People of color. Mm-hmm. The army had begun to desegregate, what was it, in 1947? Mm-hmm. And again, back to General Ned Ullman and the attitude toward people of color. You know, he was put in command of, what was it, the 92nd Infantry Division, which was comprised almost entirely of African Americans.
During World War II.
During World War II, that's right. Mm-hmm. And the reason for this was because Ullman was from the South. Uh-huh. But did he respect these men?
No, he did not. He blamed, you know, all their shortcomings on the fact that they were African American. He just said, Negroes, as he wrote, they can't fight. We shouldn't have them in our forces. He actually campaigned for this position after the World War II and after the Korean War and maintained that position for the rest of his life. General Smith of the Marines had a very different attitude about it. He didn't care what your background was, your ethnicity, your race. Once you're a Marine, you're a Marine. And he had presided over the integration of the 1st Marine Division without any incident. And they fought nobly and bravely and right alongside every other people of every other background. So it was really not an issue with Smith, but it was for Ullman.
And on the ground, you know, perhaps it wasn't as much of an issue for many of the men who were fighting at the time. You tell the story of Jesse Brown, the first black fighter pilot in the U.S. Navy, mm-hmm. who was – tell us his story and the story of his good friend Tom Hudner. They mm-hmm. were two people from completely different background, mm-hmm. and yet they met in a very important moment in the war.
Right. Well, Jesse Brown was the first Navy pilot flying off of an aircraft carrier in the Navy, and Hudner – well, I should say Jesse Brown was from a sharecropper family in Mississippi near Hattiesburg. He was an accomplished aviator. Hudner was from Massachusetts near Boston. His brother went to Harvard. Another brother went to Princeton. He went to the Naval Academy, came from privilege. But these two men met and flew together in the Korean War, flew off this one aircraft carrier one day when Jesse Brown's plane, his Corsair, was shot down. He had to crash land in the mountains.
So what was their purpose in doing this? Let's roll back a little bit in terms of the retreat.
Well, as the men were retreating to the coast, aviators were flying overhead and strafing the Chinese and in some cases dropping, horrific as it sounds to us now, napalm on these forces, keeping them at bay so that the Americans could keep their march going to the sea. During the course of this flyover, Jesse Brown's plane was shot down. He crash-landed in a clearing in the mountains. His plane erupted in flames. And Tom Hudner is flying overhead looking at his buddy. And the Navy protocol was, do not do anything crazy. No heroics here. Just, you know, don't crash another plane. In trying to save your buddy. But he ignored that instinct. He ignored that protocol.
He could see because Jesse Brown was waving at him.
Exactly.
That he was still alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he decides to crash land his own plane in the same clearing, risk his own life to try to save his buddy. And for this act of heroism, he thinks he's going to be court-martialed, but he ultimately, in fact, is awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. One of many set pieces in this book. There's just so many stories like this. It's almost an embarrassment of narrative riches. You know, all these individual stories of heroism and valor and sacrifice.
And so the next question is, how did you come across these stories? The book is rich in detail. Where did you find this? Where did you even begin?
Well, The Chosen Reservoir has been written a lot about in, you know, especially there are a lot of military history buffs who know some of these stories. So I started by burrowing into the literature. But the lifeblood of this book, I think, is the interviews I did with these guys at reunions, on this trip to Korea that I talked about earlier, going to their homes, going to their diners, you know, hanging out with these guys. That's where you really get the good stories. And I thoroughly enjoy that part of the process. It's just so much fun hanging out with these guys who, you know, this is the generation that we're saying goodbye to. This is, unfortunately, a lot of these guys that I interviewed, Tom Hudner, for example, have passed away since then. My stepfather was in the Korean War, and he died this summer. So,
Was that one of the reasons? I mean, this summer, obviously, you were researching long before that.
Well, I mean, my project has gone back for three 4 years, but certainly I wanted to pay tribute to this generation, the Korean War generation. These are tough old guys. They're amazing guys. Their war is forgotten. It shouldn't be forgotten. No one should forget what these guys went through, not just in the Chosen Reservoir battle, but all the battles of the Korean War. These are the guys that are exiting the stage now, and we need to recognize them.
Hampton Sides, so what are your thoughts about the direction which modern warfare increasingly seems to be headed, in which perhaps you engage in warfare, but you don't see your enemy you can engage remotely?
Drones and this sort of asymmetrical warfare we see in Afghanistan and Iraq. I don't know. I think that's why the Marines today, when they go through training, they study this battle. This is one of the battles that every Marine knows this story of Chosen Reservoir. It's one of the battles they celebrate at the Marine Corps Museum in Quantico.
Well, why are they studying it? What are they trying to learn from it?
Part of it is because what you were just alluding to, I think, is that, you know, this was a battle in which they were engaging with the enemy close range, hand-to-hand combat. Marksmanship was excellent marksmanship was imperative. An understanding of sort of the classic military maneuvers was imperative. This was not a drone battle. This was not a virtual battle. This was, you know, blood and sweat and tears in the snow. And, it's a battle that I think will always be one of the classic clashes in American history.
What next for you?
Well, I've been doing cold weather stories for a while. My last book was about an expedition in the Arctic. This one was set in 30 below zero weather in North Korea.
Time to
now,
warm up.
Now I'm writing a book about Captain James Cook, who went to Hawaii and Fiji and Tahiti. I'm going to warm up a little bit and write about his explorations in the Pacific.
Well, Hampton Sides, once again, a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you
Great
so much.
Great to be
much.
With you.
His newest book is On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle. And as always, we invite you to check out Radio Times on social media or listen to our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producer is Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stearns. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks as always for joining us for Radio Times.